Okay.
He worked at, I think
so
it's...
Before you start with your uncle, we need to have you introduce yourself so that it's recorded. So if you just say your name and then we'll start from there.
Okay. The name is Victor Bell with one L. My uncle Dominic, which was my father's twin brother, worked at, I guess it was called the Fort William Elevator Company, just down here in Westport. And his job was, I think, oiling the big drive wheels. They were huge wheels, maybe 6 feet in diameter, with ropes, and they drove all the machinery in the elevator. For some reason, I believe he got hit on the head. He went in there to oil it, and I guess he wasn't paying attention, and he got hit on the head. That would be 1940-something, just after the war. I don't remember.
And he was killed in that accident.
Yes, he was a bachelor, so there was no children. And my father worked at the Grand Trunk Pacific Elevator at that time, which later became the National, and then became Cargill. He worked there from the day he arrived in Canada from Italy.
Do you know approximately when that was, that he arrived from Italy?
1920-something.
20-something. So
I don't really know the exact day.
Yeah. Did your dad ever talk about working at the elevators, what it was like there? The interactions with, you know, the different staff?
You got to remember that he never learned that, or he wasn't comfortable with English.
Okay.
And I, growing up, was never into the Italian language bit, so we had a little difficulty with interrelationships, I guess you would say.
Communicating even in the family.
Yeah, yeah. I understood what he said to me, but I couldn't respond because I never spoke Italian. When you went up the street, I spoke better Ukrainian than I did Italian. So, and I don't recall him saying too much about Ella. He just went to work in the morning, came back on his bicycle.
What did he do in the elevator?
That's a good question. I think at one time he used to bring the railroad cars in with these big winches. You know, they'd pull the cars in and the other guys, the shovelers, would unload them. And then he would shoot them out and bring them in. And as they unloaded them, he would replace a full car. That's the days when they had the old wooden box car, where they would have to open up the car and break all these green doors. You ever hear of green doors?
Mm-hmm.
And it was that era, before the tanker car and all that sort of stuff.
Before the hoppers.
Oh, way before hoppers, yeah.
So would all of the other workers at the elevator have been, at that level, been Italian then?
No. It was a mixture of Italian, Ukrainian, Poles. I'm trying to think of... I was only a young kid, so mm-hmm. I can't remember what... They used to call them the Bicycle Brigade because they'd start here in Westport, and they'd be on their bicycle, and you'd see them all going down the road to right to Chippewa with a bicycle until the snow arrived, and then they got on the buses or streetcars.
Streetcars?
Yeah.
So they would take off from, like, your family grew up around Frederica?
Yeah.
The Frederica and James area?
Yeah, they would come from all that area, up around Brown Street, wherever they were happening to be living, and they would all be on their bicycles.
Heading across the bridge at
across
at
the bridge, Patterson's? Yeah. And then in the wintertime, the streetcar only went to, I think it went to Chippewa Park, or one of the paper mills, so they would get off and they'd have to walk quite a ways into the elevators there. That's my recollection. In the end, later years, he ended up being a watchman in the elevators. So after everybody left, you know, for the weekend, he would be the watchman. He'd go and make his rounds, make sure they didn't have any fires or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever go to the elevators with him when you were a young kid?
Yeah, I remember going during the holidays. It was the 4 to 12. He was doing the 4 to 12 shift on watchman. And I remember going and just totally terrified of the place.
What was it like?
Well, it was dark. It was quiet. A lot of strange noises. But he would take me upstairs in the hoist, you know, the elevator. And he'd go to various keys, and there was dust, and there was grain, and pigeons flying through. But it was eerie at night for a small kid, eh? And I think I went once or twice, and I said, no, that's it. I don't want to go anymore. Yeah, that was in the summertime. Because then I used to have to ride on the crossbar of the bicycle, which he had padded for me. Yeah, that wasn't a very pleasant experience. So that's my recollections.
You'd be alone then in the elevators at that time of day?
Yeah.
Or night?
Well, it was 4 to 12, yeah. So he would start making his rounds. Everybody had gone home. Like, say it was, I don't know, holiday or something. And everybody had gone home, so they had watchmen 24 hours a day there. So he'd go around with this little whatever he had, stick the key in and say that he'd been to that post at a certain time, and then continue on. So I'd follow him, but it was a scary place.
Would he have to go to the top of the elevator?
Right to the top, and you could see the open bins, you know, with the grain, and walking on the catwalks, and it scared the hell out of me. It wasn't too pleasant.
So they didn't have the bin covers then?
No. That, a lot of them had open bins. Still some today have open bins.
Hmm. And did you get out to the outside to look out over the city?
Well, you'd look out through a dusty window, but...
That was it.
Hmm.
Now, your uncle, mm-hmm. you said, worked at the Fort William elevator.
Right.
So is that in that stand sort of mid-Frederica?
Yeah, just off of, there was three in a row there, three or four. Where the overhead walk bridge is at the foot of Brown Street, it was one of those. I think it was called a Fort William elevator. I think it's still there today. I'm not too sure.
Yeah, there's two there.
There used to be three today. Or four.
Okay.
Some got knocked down. I think maybe the city owns most of them now.
Did you ever know anything about that stand of elevators? Like, was that sort of the playground area for Westport kids?
I've been into those elevators. I used to inspect them. So I know them, you know, like the back of my hand. But as a kid, no. I don't recall going that far. See, that's quite a ways from where I lived. And we didn't venture that far.
Mm-hmm.
You stayed around your own little area.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about those elevators up in that area. Because, before I do that, I want to go back to your uncle. He had an accident that killed him, but if I recall, he had an earlier accident as well.
Yeah, I never got too much details of that. At the end, his hand was missing. I heard, the story goes that he had a hunting accident. He was quite a hunter, and I think he was going over a fence or something. Or I don't know, the gun went off or whatever, the shotgun, and they had to take his hand off. So he was missing a hand.
And still doing this physical labor.
Oh, yeah, he still drove a car. Yeah.
At the elevator.
Yeah. He lived right next. He had a house right just at the foot of King Street. The last house there. And he didn't have that far to go. But, he still did his job.
That's right beside one of those elevators, or pretty close to the King's Street.
Yeah, it's the last house on
that. Butts up into the...
Yeah, and then there's a little road goes to some of the elevators.
Mm-hmm.
And he had owned that last house. And, I never did get the story. Well, as a young kid, you're not interested in that kind of stuff anyway. He was my father's twin brother.
Okay, let's switch then to... In spite of the fact that you didn't care for being in the elevator from 4 to 12, you ended up with a career that took you into a lot of elevators. So tell us a bit about how you got involved in the grain trade.
How to get involved in the grain trade. I really wasn't interested in the grain trade. I didn't. That's the last place I wanted to work. Anyways, it was a posting for grain samplers. I finished high school, and at that time I was having a hard time finding an apprenticeship. I wanted to be an electrician, and I didn't find an apprenticeship, so there was a posting in the paper for grain samplers. Somebody said, put your name in for that, what the hell you got to lose? So I got an interview, got hired for 3 months, got laid off, because they're only temporary, you know, just for the summer rush. The next year he called me again, I went again, but I really wasn't interested in grain trade.
Who was this with?
Canadian Grain, well, it'd be Board of Grain Commissioners at that time.
For the summer sampling?
Mm-hmm. And I think that went for 5 or 6. Well, once you get hooked into there, I don't know. You don't get too much ambition to do anything else, I guess. So anyway, I stayed there till with the Grain Commission till 1965 or 66.
Always as a sampler?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I really wasn't interested in being a grain inspector. Just a means to an end, I guess.
Why weren't you interested in being a grain inspector?
I don't know, just like to sit there and count the kernels, and it just wasn't my bag, I guess. And then in 65, or you know, this I had never written it down, 66, there was another posting for, what the heck did they call it then? Inspecting ships and elevators for bugs and stuff. So I said, well, that might be interesting. So I applied for that and was successful and carried on back into the elevators again.
I'd like to sort of divide the discussion up here into a couple of areas. One is because the jobs that you had took you into the different elevators, mm-hmm. I'd like to ask about some elevators that I'm particularly interested in because they're not here anymore. Do you recall the elevators that were up near the Great Lakes paper mill, now Bowater?
Yes.
Tell me what you remember about those elevators, their names and whatever you can think of.
There was one that was right next to the Great Lakes paper mill, which is now Bowater. And it was the last one on that side. It was right next to the Great Lakes. And I think it was called the Electric. I remember it was all wood. You know, the workhouse. And it was wood. I remember that. And there had been so much walking on the wood over the years that the knots were up and the rest was worn out, you know, and you had wood stairs going up. I can't remember what year it was closed, but it was shortly thereafter that I started inspecting that it was gone, it was closed. But I remember going there and we were walking and I keep seeing these larvae running around and somebody said, oh, those are mealworms, or the guy I was with. They're mealworms. He said, you want to save them, good for fishing. But all through the cracks, you know, on the lumber floor and various places where there was lumber, there was mealworms, and they were just full of them.
What size were they?
They'd be about fully grown, but that long, about an inch, yellow. And some of the guys, they told me they would get as much larvae as they can, and they would put them in tins with, what the heck did they feed cattle with? What do you call it? Brand. And they would keep getting these new generations for fishing. So they loved them for fishing. Instead of worms, you had the mealworms. But it was an all-wood place. I think it eventually burnt. They were tearing it down and caught fire.
So were the bins concrete?
The bins, no, they were concrete. See, this is where I really never kept track of that. I could picture in my mind that it's sitting there, but that's about it. And then next door was a Northwestern, and that was all concrete, and they tore that one out. I think it was two there, but the Electric was all wood. And another one that was all wood was the Empire in the East End, and it again was all wood construction. And it had the big steam engine. That's the one, yeah. It had a steam engine in a separate part, and it, the big wheel, and it drove all the machinery in the elevator, if I recall.
If I recall correctly, I've had a phone call from someone that they actually salvaged that steam engine.
On college, isn't it?
And are holding it somewhere safely, along with a little pot of money for its preservation.
Really? I thought I read someplace that it was sitting there at Conn College.
Out in the yard?
There was one outside with a big wheel on it. No, I could be wrong. For some reason, I thought that's where I read something about the engineering department or something, and it was a steam-driven, it's the steam engine from one of the elevators.
Well, we'll check that out. So the Northwestern then, down at the Turning Basin, I think they call it.
Or was it, wait a minute, was it the Western Terminal? Might have been the Western Terminal. I think one over here at the foot of Brown Street was Northwestern. See, I my memory's gone.
The names change over the years.
Yeah, too. You want to get an older person to meet it with some elevators. It probably no more.
So anything that distinguished that elevator, the second one, at the
Western Terminal. I think that was the Western Terminal because that'd be the last one on the. No, they were all basically the same, mm-hmm. you know.
And then moving down the river.
Moving down the river. Then there was three or four here.
Well, Patterson.
Patterson, right. That's the one that had the storage bins. They called them the pagoda, I think, because their roofs were, I think it was the pagoda. And that was a pretty old elevator. Yeah. They'd always tell you, don't park your car near the pagoda roof, you know, outside because of the snow. The spring, and it would all just slide off. And I think once they got a car that was badly damaged, and it creaked and groaned every time the wind blew. But there again, it was just an elevator, right? Like, basically, they're all the same. No, that one, Patterson had a spiral staircase that went right up to the top. You know, the workhouse? It had a spiral staircase. And my boss and I would start at the bottom, and by the time we got to the top, we get quite dizzy with this spiral staircase. We thought it was really a real hoot. But I would have loved to have got a piece of it when they were demolishing it. And I think Pat Doherty, I knew from Patterson, said, well, you can get it out, you can have it. And I thought, oh my God, I have to get a crane to get it out. But it was the neatest thing I ever saw.
Was it quite artistic besides?
No, it was just a novelty. It was a spiral staircase, and I'd never seen one.
So where would it go in the workhouse? Like,
Well, you know, when you go to a workhouse, I'll call it a workhouse, you get in this little cage, which they called a hoist. But they also had stairs. Sometimes they're right in where the hoist goes up. Excuse me.
No. So we're talking about the spiral staircase and...
Don't make a big deal out of that.
Well, you were talking... No, I think it is different, and that's what we're looking for. Yeah. Is, so, Ian, where should we start up?
Let's begin at the beginning, day one. How did you go to the elevator? How did you walk in on your first day?
Okay. Can we finish the elevators along the way and then do that?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay. So are we ready to go? Are we on?
We're underway.
Okay. You were talking about the difference between the Patterson workhouse, and you were saying, you know how you go up in the hoist, but this elevator, and then there's stairs that come
down. They had a hoist,
down.
But they also had a staircase going up. All of them always had stairs to get to the right to the top, the elevator, along with the hoist. Some you pulled a rope to get the hoist to go up. Others you had a button. There was 26 elevators, and there was 26 different ways of... Basically, there was at a hoist, or you could take the stairs.
If we move down the river, we have that set of three elevators, I think.
How many is there right now? Three? I think there's three there. I think there was four. I think one they bashed down that was right next. Don't quote me. Then you got to where?
The island, or the...
Not that
no, Chippewa.
Island. Oh, Chippewa. Oh, okay. It was Cargill, which it was the National, and before that was a Grand Trunk Pacific elevator. And right next door was, I always knew it as the Searle Elevator, which was owned by somebody in Winnipeg. Is it the two there?
Anything that distinguished those two from your experience?
No. Again, it's they're all basically the same design, you know. Some are bigger than others. Then the next one you got to was over here by the Jackknife Bridge, which was used to be what, Robin Hood?
Ogilvy's.
Now Sasspool. And then you went along and the next one was
at the mouth of the river.
Empire. And then you got to the Intercity Group.
What about the Intercity Group? Any thoughts about those?
I can't even remember what the
P&H.
P&H, yes. That's still going today, isn't it? P&H, Parrish and Heimbrecker. The nice small little elevator. Then it was Pool One. See, some of the older guys would know them by different names. And then from Pool One, you had what? Pool Three? No.
UGG. M.
No. Wait a minute. You had Pool One. And what was next to cross from Pool One?
Became UGGM, and then there was Thunder Bay Elevator, a little elevator beside it, and then...
The old Thunder Bay Elevator, yes, that's right.
Was it still operational when you were...
Yes, it was, yeah. When I first started back in 66 with the food production and marketing branch there, Plant Quarantine or whatever it is now today, that was operating, that's right. There was another oldie.
And then Pool 7.
Pool 7, yeah. And then there was Pool 3. Pool 7 was the one I missed.
Malting was in there.
Canada Malting also, yes.
Any differences in the Canada...
Excuse me.
In the Canada Malting operation and setup?
No, it was a grain terminal. Except he had the malt house. Where they did all the treating and making the malting, I guess, the malt. And then you got to Pool 6... by itself, and then again you got the other cluster. There was Pool 2, and it was operating when I was gainfully employed. And then the rest, Richardson's and United Grain Growers.
Was there a Pool 5 there, between Richardson's and Pool 4 A and B? And then there's the last one in that current river stand.
Pool 5. See, one of them down here was Pool 5 at one time. So
in Westport,
yeah, if I recall, Pool 5.
Pool 5 was where the 1945 explosion was.
Oh, it was Sasspool 4, Sasspool 4A and 4B. That was again, yeah.
Not around when you were. I don't know whether they rebuilt after the explosion.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, that's Pool 4A and 4B. I don't know what they're called today.
Same.
Still 4A and 4B?
Yeah.
In fact, when I was there talking to some of the fellows, they were, I was trying to tell them, you got to keep the place clean, you're getting too much dirt, you know, dust, and do not tell us about keeping clean and dust, and he'd pull up his shirt, and there was all this scar tissue from when the elevator blew back in the 40s, where he got burnt with the flash. I still remember that. He pulled up his shirt, and he said, look at that. And he had been in the explosion. So, yeah. So I really can't remember what the
series of elevators was
there.
Yeah,
like, how quickly you forget.
Yeah.
But I do know there was 26 elevators, there was operating elevators when I was working. And I've been in all of them to inspect them.
Were they closing down over the time of your career?
Yes. the two, I believe, over here near the Bowater plant, the Empire was closed. Pool 2 was closed eventually. And what other ones? That's about all I can think of.
The Frederica Avenue ones, or the ones on the... The little ones there?
Yeah, they eventually closed. Well, they opened, they closed, they went from grain, they went to pellets, like off of board grain, you know, that they were sort of, I don't know, and then they got mustard seed, and I don't know if today they're operating under the board. Mm-hmm.
The one we missed and the one that you were talking about when you said there was four along that stretch, Elevator D.
Westland D, that's right. Yeah, it's West. See, there you go, right on the curve here. Westland D was a... they were a cooperative between Richardson's and I don't know who else. So they were just an overflow house between two companies that ran it. So when their regular houses, grain terminals here filled up, they would transfer their cargo, their grain coming in over to the Westland D. That's right, Westland D. And it's gone now, isn't it? Yeah.
Okay, let's switch back to something specific, and that's your job as the, you were talking about being a sampler, but let's go to the job
with
the bug guy.
With food production and marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was the official title of that job?
I think they were the designation of technical officer, whatever that meant. Yeah. That was back in 65 or 66. There was a huge grain sales, I guess, to Russia at that time. And they had complained about finding extraneous material in grain. So agriculture, what was it, food production and marketing? Anyways, they were going to hire more people to inspect the ships. I think at that time there was one fellow here at the Lakehead, excuse me, and his biggest thing was make sure there was no insects in the ships. And he wasn't too much concerned about extraneous material in the holds, as far as I know.
Well, extraneous materials would be things like?
Broken glass, nails, lumber, beer bottles. So they had this competition, and I got hired, and we started inspecting the ships. Well, there had been somebody here all the time. As soon as the Seaway opened up and they started coming with directly in for overseas cargoes, they had a man here, and all he did was inspect the ships. Because Canada guaranteed that the grain they sold you was free and clear of insects and diseases. And they issued you what they call an international phytosanitary certificate.
An international what?
Phytosanitary certificate.
Phytosanitary.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a worldwide certificate that countries around the world respect each other's. If you were to buy something in Finland, you would have to get a permit to import from Agriculture Canada, and you would have to meet the import requirements of whatever you're importing from Finland, say a grain of some sort. You'd have to meet the requirements of the Canadian requirements of a phytosanitary, like no diseases, no insects. And then the Finnish agriculture would inspect the crop, and they would issue a phytosanitary certificate to the Canadian government saying, we've met all your requirements, we guarantee that it's clear, free and clear of whatever. So it's a cross type of thing. So we were inspecting the ships and issuing them a permit to load the grain. Because later on, after they were finished loading it, we would issue a phytosanitary certificate for that cargo, which stated no extraneous material meets the import requirements of the importing country, whether it be Russia, Saudi Arabia, whoever. And that was based on the inspection of agriculture, which later became that part later became plant quarantine. I think today it's called Canadian Food Inspection Agency, so it's changed names.
So does that mean then in that job you had to know the import regulations for those various countries?
You would have binders and binders full of the requirements of most countries in the world. Ottawa would keep, if some country changed their import requirements, they would send out and we would get this thing, we'd put it under whatever country it was and have to run there to the book.
What would you say about the differences that existed among the countries' restrictions?
I have no clue.
In general?
I think they're all basically wanting, they didn't want your pests, stored products, grain pests of stored products to be introduced into their country. Because what is not rampant here could be rampant with the right conditions over there. Could wipe out their forests, could wipe out everything. So basically they didn't want our insects, we didn't want theirs, and that's about it.
Is it possible for you to describe a typical day on the job?
Well, when you say job, basically we did ship inspection, foreign ships coming to load. But when there are not any ships here to load of foreign registry, we would be inspecting the grain elevators. Or people wanting to bring in nursery stock. They'd phone you up at the customs and say, well, such and such has got a load of nursery stock from the United States, or they've got tulip bulbs from Holland. So this was part of your... Or somebody wants to send a truckload of plants to some nursery in Duluth. We'd have to go and inspect them, make sure that there was no insects and they were looking healthy and meet the requirements of the importing country, which would be the United States. So if we're not doing elevators, we're doing all this other little... We're also responsible for the Port of Churchill. So one of us would get sent to the Port of Churchill for 6 weeks. Then come back, and then they'd have to send somebody from Montreal because there's only two of us here. So when one fellow went to Churchill, the other's stuck here, whether he's sick or whatever, for 6 weeks, he's got to do everything, 7 days a week. But normally, if we got a call to do a ship, we would, whether it would be out on the anchorage or at dockside, we would meet the ship, interview the captain.
Who puts out the call to you?
The ship's agent. There was two ship's agents here at one time. It was Lakehead Shipping and Lake Superior Shipping. They represented the ship when they pulled in. So we would go down and inspect the ship, certified whether it was okay to load.
What was involved in inspecting a ship? How would you actually do it?
Physically going down to the hold and start looking around in nooks and crannies and climb wherever you can. Get on your hands and knees and see if you can spot insects regularly in your little travels. Make sure there was no rust, no oil grease stains. Make sure it was clean. And right behind us would be what we call the port warden, who was certifying the ship was going to be safely travel through the St. Lawrence Seaway and safely travel across the ocean. He was doing stability and safety of the ship where they were loading the grain. So there was two of us down there, each one doing a separate thing.
Do you remember the name of the port wardens that you worked with?
Oh, there's been...
Many?
Yeah. Some have died, some have moved away. I don't know who's doing it now. There was quite a few. They were under steamship inspection.
I don't know if you can think back to the early days on that job and what it felt like when you first went down in a ship hold.
It was interesting. It was scary because back then it seems like every old ship that they get their hands off, particularly the old, what they called victory ships from the Second World War, they were meant to be, I guess they were what, expandable? Expendable? Anyways, they were a piece of garbage, actually. They were meant to carry goods to wherever. and they weren't in very good shape. I think they might have been sitting in mothballs after the war, and all of a sudden they were showing up here for grain. So as soon as we got aboard, we're looking around and say, oh, this is going to be a week cleanup job. So everybody was in there with getting all the rust off, and it was coming off like huge sheets of paper. It was just a massive headache to get these ships to be presentable to load a grain.
So they would have come into port without anything in them?
They would discharge goods in Montreal or Hamilton Steel or wherever, and then they would come up here to pick up a load so they could make it both ways. They'd bring cargo in, take cargo out. So they were making money both ways. And these were old clunkers from the 40s, from the Second World War. So I guess there was enough call that these ships were brought into service, and then some of them were steam, if I recall steam. Anyway, they were in terrible shape, so it was a real good experience to try to get these ships cleaned up.
How do you get down in a hold?
Well, they had these little hatch covers, and then the ladder. And half the time you didn't know whether the ladder was safe or not because you looked down and looked well. But you got there and you put your hand on it and the weld was broken. Anyways, and of course we never had any safety apparatus like a rope or anything. Usually one person went down. Things have changed now. They've got harnesses. It has to be two people and they have to be attached with a harness and the whole thing. But then we just went down with a flashlight in our back pocket and a hard hat, and that was it. And some of them were in awful shape. They spent 5, 6, 7 days to get ready to clean, to get the ship ready, that we would say, yes, it's fine to load and get the garbage out. And they were in terrible shape.
What were the most interesting things you found in ship's holds? And
what do you mean by interesting? See, by the time we got to them, they were cleaned out.
Cleaned out, but not up. Not cleaned up.
Some of them I've been into. I remember one particular ship. It came in and it was raining out, so they didn't want to open up the hatches because it was raining. And there was no lights in it, so I have my light on the hard hat. And I can remember something falling on, hitting my hard hat, and saying, God love us, the hatch cover must be leaking. Anyways, I took the hat off, and here was weevils. They were just raining weevils. You know, you could hear them hitting the deck. They were falling, you know, off the beams. And of course, by that time I'd had it. I think I did three holes. And I said, this is a fumigation job. And I went back and I said to the captain, what was your last cargo? Sometimes we have a language barrier. Finally, I made out it was peanuts. He carried peanuts from Africa. And the thing was just raining insects, because the peanuts were all stuck on the, and I don't know, the weevils were falling down. Anyways, we had to gas that thing. That's the first time I ever had raining insects on me, just loaded. So that's when they bring in the methyl bromide, and everybody goes to the hotel, and guards are posted, and they put the gas in and fumigate.
When I hear fumigation and food stuffs together, I'm a little worried. So what, just because of residues and so on, what were the considerations for residues once something like a fumigation job was done?
Well, first of all, if there is residues, we find of whatever this. Normally, it was up in the, like these arches that, it's not like the ships today, that these were arches, sort of, right? Huge arches. And a big ledge on the top. And the residues would get up. And of course, they're unloading copra, peanuts, rice, or whatever. And nobody would go up there. They sucked it out, I guess, in some of these ports. They had buckets, whatever, how they unloaded it in Rotterdam or wherever. And nobody went up there to sweep off these beams. So over the years, months or whatever, tropics, wherever they were going, if there was larvae eggs, they would be hatching. By the time they got here and we started really intensifying our search, by then we were finding larvae, we were finding adult insects. So now we have to get the boys to sweep all the residue down. They would sweep it all down. And then they would put it in a pile in the bottom of the hold. And if it was warranted, mostly it was, we would have a fumigation. The residue was sitting there with all the bugs in it. We didn't take it off. So after they fumigated, then we'd go down and we'd take samples of that residue, take it back to the office, process it to make sure there's no live insects. Then we'd have them take the residue out. So now, there was no residue by the time our grain is going into the hole.
But what about residue of the chemical used to, or the spray used to do the fumigation?
The sprays were your normal sprays that you would buy in Canadian Tire. Malathion, diazinon. The gas, of course, is deadly, but it was pumped out by the time anybody's ready to go into the hole, which would be us. Normally the fumigator sent his son down to say it was all clear. Oh, sorry. That was funny. Anyways, they would have fans going and they would blow it out, I guess, move the air, get the methyl bromide gas out. And we'd say to them, well, what kind of test do you have to make sure there's no gas left pockets? I send my son down. If he comes back up, it's okay. He's a chuckle over that. Yeah, so they would open up the hatches and they would have these fans down there to circulate this gas to make sure it penetrates everything. Very costly affair. When you think you got to put 35, 36 men in a hotel for 2 days and a night, and hopefully they're there the next morning when you put them back on the ship, because otherwise they're all points west or east in Canada, you're looking for them.
Did that happen?
Oh, sure, a lot of them. They just took off. They didn't have a visa, but they're in Canada, so off they went. Of course, the ship would have to post a big bond. We had that happen lots in Churchill. But Churchill, they could catch them because either the railroad goes 3 times a week or they just sit at the airport and wait because there's no road out of there. So if they'd catch them at the airport, they'd say, oh, I'm missing a crew member. They would notify customs and they'd check the airport. A lot of spies at the airport, too, say, well, we got this Greek sailor who's going to spot a ticket. Oh, he doesn't have a visa. So back you go to the ship.
In Thunder Bay, it'd be a little more difficult, though.
Thunder Bay, well, they could hide as in the whatever ethnic group they were with. They could just disappear.
Ship could still sail without them?
I think they did, yeah. And if they did catch the person, well, it was all up to the ship's company to pay for expenses that they incurred looking for this guy. And then when they caught him in deportation or whatever it was, the ship had to pay for this. So sometimes they were pretty choosy who was being let off the ship. But we didn't have that many in Thunder Bay that were jumping. Things had gotten better on the ships. I think today you don't have that problem with fumigations on a ship because it's just a steel box. It's like the Lakers years ago, they had all these arches and it was just a horrible mess. Like the 20s and 30s architecture of the ship. And then as it got later on, you could just see it was just one huge box. They'd turn a hose on it, pump it out, and we're ready to go. Because time is money in the ships.
So let's switch to the elevator inspection. Mm-hmm. What did that entail?
Well, prior to this fiasco, they call it, I guess with the Russians complaining about, I guess they got a better deal on the price. Extraneous material in the grain from Montreal and all this. They said, well, if we're going to inspect the ships for insects and extraneous material, we're going to start really inspecting the places where we're storing the grain. So then we started going into elevator inspection. So basically it was get in the hoist, go right to the top floor, start walking around, making notes, taking a lot of samples. We used to take a lot. We had a huge amount of bags, small bags, in our pocket. And we'd go around poking corners, a lot of damp grain, whatever. Take a sample, mark it where you got it, and just make notes of, you know, debris here. This has gone moldy, this wet grain here, a lot of pigeon poop. Just general cleanliness, as you would do in your house. Vacuuming, sweeping. Don't leave the grain laid there too long in one spot. If it's damp, keep cleaning it out. Just general housekeeping. This had never been done by, I think, the federal government. They just left it up to the company, and nobody ever really So then at that time, we had instituted a regular elevator inspection. So by the time we got to the west end of Fort William, it was time to start again on the east end of Port Arthur. We did this. It was just the two of us here. So we did it on a regular basis.
Who was the other fellow at the time you were working?
Well, there was three fellows that worked. I stayed and they moved on. So there's no point in giving a name because they're...
Gone.
So
what kinds of issues did you uncover at the various elevators? Ever any?
Oh, it was just trying to keep the place tidy. You know, over the years, they didn't really, if they had a little bit of a spill, they would sweep it up and throw it on the belt and take it away. But nothing that really, conscious effort to keep it day by day.
Were there some elevators that were better housekeepers than
yes,
others?
Yes, there was some that really, Canada Malt stands right out. They were really right up on cleaning. They're paranoid about it because they've got a product that they're selling for consumption, shall I say, for beer or whatever, into the United States or wherever. So they're very, very cooperative and they're very conscious about keeping it clean. Some of the other ones, yes, they made it conscious. But you have to remember, a lot of these elevators are pretty old. And just the design of them didn't make it for keeping good housekeeping, unless you put a whole crew on every day to keep it clean. The minute you start moving grain, these places got untidy with grain falling off the belts. The architecture of them was not meant for keeping things clean. Should I say clean or just tidy? I don't know. There's so much movement. There's belts above you, belts on the side of you, and it's just moving grain all the time. So there's gonna be. But they were very good. When we started, it was a fight to say, look, you got to keep it clean, just for even for explosion's sake, you got to keep it clean. And back in the 90s, when I retired, they were doing a very good job at trying to keep it clean with what they were working with, you know, the architecture or the design of the elevators. I don't know what it is like today, but we had good cooperation from them. We do our report, we test all the samples, and if we did find insects or whatever, we would send them a report, tell them, and they would get right on it. They would hire somebody to spray the area, clean it up. They were very good about that. But there was 26 elevators, only two of us, plus all the other duties, so that sometimes a month would go by before we got back to some of these places. It was an impossible thing to really keep on a daily basis, but when time permitted, we did the inspections.
When you're talking, I'm thinking about the connection between the grain inspectors and your group. Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say that the grain inspectors would be the ones who'd be looking for the bugs and whatever as the shipments came in, bugs and diseases?
Yeah, well you mean as far as the grain coming from the west? Yes, they would be picking up if there was insects in the grain because they're handling the product. We didn't do that. They were handling the product coming into the grain elevator.
So if they found a problem,
they would treat it.
They would treat it.
They'd notify the grain elevator company that they have to treat that, and they would treat it.
So you wouldn't get your group wouldn't get
no.
involved in that then. So you're
no.
more in the elevator as a prevention.
Right. So when the product was being loaded, that was up to the grain commission to make sure that it was clear. When we did inspections of the elevator, we would pick at random. We'd pick one set of bins, you know, the big silos, and we would go down the whole length and take a little sample of each one just on a regular basis and take it back and check for insects. But it was just impossible to check everything. So they were the first hand. They were taking the sample as the ship is being loaded, so they would have the sample, and then they would look at it.
I asked you earlier when you were talking about the inspection of the ship, mm-hmm. you know, what unusual things
unusual?
Did you find in the elevators? Any things that stick out in your mind as memorable findings?
Memorable findings. A few times we were on ships, and this person would come out and say, "What are you doing?" And we'd say, "Well, we're looking for insects." And he would grab us by the arm, and if "You find insects, what do you do?" And we say, "Well, we'll fumigate the ship." Well, he said, "Please, do the galley. We'd like to fumigate the galley, but we have cockroaches. It's not up to me. Not up to me. It's up to the Department of Health." Well, who was it? Health and Welfare Canada? Then there was another inspector came around and checked for, he checked for rodents. He checked for, he came along with this ultraviolet light to see if he could see any droppings of rats or, it didn't have too much to do with him, but I'd come across them once or twice, unless they had a report of rats. But if we found rats, we'd report it. But mm-hmm. other than that, no. It was interesting, but after a while, it got to be boredom too.
Routine. Yeah. So I've often wondered about the wildlife, not people, of the elevators. But maybe you have stories of people, wildlife too.
Rats.
Is that it? Just rats?
I never really seen that many rats in the elevator, or even mice, because they had a program of keeping the rodents down, but not outside, because that's totally impossible. Because over the years, they used to take all the damp, wet grain and just dump it out in their fields, eh? So that's just a nice spot for breeding of mice and rats. One time, we ran into at Westland, the boys had caught a muskrat, was it a muskrat? And they had him in a cage. Vicious looking animal. And they were all taunting it. Thought it was great fun. And once we were in inner city, and was it inner city? And some guy, we were in the tunnels, and somebody says, "You gotta be careful, there's a bear roaming around here." I said, "Yeah, sure, there's a bear roaming around." So we're going along, taking our samples, all of a sudden this black thing crosses one of the belts. We said, ran out of there pretty quick, and it was a bear had gotten in there. I think they eventually got him out. But other than that, there was no wildlife.
Deer, again, coming to the...
No, I didn't see any deer. No, can't remember anyways.
Okay, I'm just going to check my standard questions here. I think you've dealt with a lot of them, but... this is more of a general philosophical question. When you think about your job, what did you ever think of its connection to Canada's success as a grain exporter?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, as far as I knew, Canada guaranteed that when you got the grain, it was free and clear of insects and extraneous material. Much as humanly possible. They inspected the grain coming from the west. It was inspected when it was stored, cleaned. It was inspected prior to loading, and the conveyance of the grain to your wherever was also inspected. So they had a fantastic reputation as far as grain. What you paid for is what you got. As far as the weight goes, they had certificates guaranteeing that if you bought X thousands of bushels or tonnies, that's what you got. And if you bought this standard grade, that's what you got. So they had a very good reputation. And it's because of all this work they put into guaranteeing it that that's what you got.
Did you ever have any connection with the railways?
No. Sometimes we would ask permission and we would go and check railroad cars, take a residue sample inside the car, the tanker car.
Why would that come
about? Well, just to see if there's any insects in the railroad car. The tanker, same thing, but the tanker, again, was like a big box of steel that the ship's got to be. The old railroad cars, they were lined inside, so if you broke a broken board, or sometimes the grain got behind. We just wanted to see where, if insects were there. And you would contaminate from, keep contaminating grain if you kept, if you didn't get that cleaned up. But
was that done regularly as well then?
Not that much, because it was just, again, two people. You can't do too much. You can't, you know, it'd take an awful lot of people just to look at all the rain. You know, if they're unloading 1,000 boxcars a day, you just couldn't keep up. So we did it as time permitted.
Was there any connection between your job and the research that was done to keep grains clean? Did you see that change over time? How
we had no
techniques or
we had no connection with that.
What would you describe as the major changes that you saw in the industry, and particularly your work over the time of your career? You went from 65 to...
92.
Okay.
I would say that the design of ships dramatically changed. By that time, I think the tanker car was already here. But even the lakes vessels, see, during... We're going back to the lake vessels now. When I started, they were still doing what they called winter storage inspection of lake elevators, vessels. And what that meant was that as soon as the shipping season was over, they would fill these lake vessels up and either park them at these elevators here, or they would go down to Montreal and park with the grain in there for all winter. They, of course, they would get storage fees, right? Like the elevator gets paid. So they had this winter storage. This, I think, was instituted right after or during the war years, winter storage. So we had to do that starting late November, December, doing winter storage inspection. So sometimes we'd get a phone call at 3 o'clock in the afternoon saying, tomorrow morning we're going to have 5 lake vessels at various elevators for winter storage. Now there's only 2 of us. So off we'd go at 10 to 7 in the morning, dark, go down and start inspecting the lake vessel and make sure it's clean and no insects. That was another one of our duties. That was a not a happy occasion, because if you got rain or they came in off the lake and it's full of ice, you're trying to get from one hole to the other on a skating rink. And then there was this man they called was he the port warden? Or was he the steamship inspection guy? He was out there and he'd have them put down their hatch covers, make sure they're tight. Then he would have them turn the hose on them. Water hose. Now, we're talking, at that time, 15, 20 below zero Fahrenheit. And of course, you got this guy with the hose, and of course, it hits steel, and it's frozen, and of course, you're slipping and sliding. But that was another part that we really didn't look forward to. And of course, they've got hatch covers on, so it's dark, so all you got is your big flashlight, whatever big light you can carry. You can start on your hands and knees looking at. The newer ones weren't bad because they were just a steel box. But the older ones, you'd walk on top of these, what they call side tanks, where they could fill with water to bring the ship down. They were up, I don't know, 10, 15 feet off the deck or 20 feet. And then you walk down these tanks and there was the arches and you walk over these arches. And you'd be checking around to make sure there's no old grain around. And this is all total darkness. And you'd go from one hole to the next hole. That's 6 holes normally they had. Then they had the self-unloaders, which had the hoppers. The hoppers were lined with, white Teflon. You're trying to get up with chains to get to the next belt, and they were just another one big hold. Again, winter storage. So, and they had, if they were carrying iron ore pellets or whatever coal, you have to make a note of that and have somebody come down and clean it up. And that was a lot of fun. I forgot about the winter storage. But I think that disappeared. I think that stopped now.
Why was he having them hose down the...
To make sure that they weren't leaking water.
Ah.
See, if he was sitting at an elevator, maybe they wouldn't unload that ship till, I don't know, April. In the meantime, you're getting nice, warm, sunny conditions, pile of snow on top of the ship, and it's melting. They didn't want the grain to get wet. Now, when you're winter storage, you have to make sure that grain is in mint condition on these lakers. So they would fasten these, they would batten down these hatch covers and make sure they're watertight. And he'd come along with a very thin little putty knife, and he'd see if he could stick his putty knife between the gasket and the hatch cover. And that's when he had him turn the hose on if he suspected it. Or he would go down underneath, see if he could see any light come penetrating through. In the meantime, we're trying to go down each hole to make sure there were clean and no insects.
How would you even get the hatch off if it was frozen ice?
They would lift the hatch off because they had their little cranes. They ran up and down, put a hook and lift it off. But it's the case of them throwing water all over the place that immediately hit the deck. It was frozen, so you're afraid of breaking your legs.
Were you ever injured on the job?
Once I fell off. There's the engine room, and then there's this big tunnel that goes right to the propeller. Of course, again, it was dark, and we shouldn't be doing things in the dark, but we did. Came down this ladder, and I thought I was on the deck, and I wasn't. I was on the engine cover, or the propeller shaft, and I fell, I think it was 8 feet down, and I think then I injured my Achilles tendon, which snapped about 4 years ago. Mm. Anyways, that's the only one. But there was no safety as we know today. I think today they've got harnesses, they've got ropes, because most of the time you didn't know the condition of this stupid ladder. Some were bashed, they were right up against the wall, you could hardly get your hands, till one day the port warden said, there were three of us then, he says, you know, this is stupid, we're risking our lives to go down that stupid hole. Look at that condition of that ladder. It was just bashed up against the bulkhead, the next hold, and you could hardly get your toes in. And he said, this is not right. And we said, no, but he said, you know what? We're not going to do any more inspections until the ladders are fixed. So he would order the ladder, so all of a sudden it's panic. So they would have to fix the ladder to our standard. Then you could see the change in the ships. In Australia, they had a law that said you could not go down a vertical ladder more than, I think, 10 feet. So all of a sudden you've seen staircases coming, which was beautiful because you went down a staircase like a civilized person with handrails. Or if they had a ladder, they had the big safety ring around it. But some of the ones that we used to go down, it's amazing that we didn't kill ourselves. They were just rungs welded in. And of course, when the buckets come to unload, they would bash them all and we'd still try to get our toes and go down. So. But I think today the safety features have vastly improved.
Speaking of safety, was it during your time on the job that they started to put in the air filters, filter systems for grain dust in the elevators?
Yeah, I think they were evolving as far as I can recall. Yeah, prior to that they didn't have any dust control. You would look out in the city and all you saw was one big cloud of grain dust. I think it was an ongoing...
Were you working in those days
in
the elevators?
Yeah. Sometimes, depending what they were unloading, you couldn't see past your arm. You know, just they'd open the windows, they'd open the doors, but that didn't help. They were just, they had no dust control.
And no masks or anything
They did have masks. The old days, they had the fellas shoveling the grain cars, the old wooden cars, and they were just a square. They would hold it, and a pulley would pull it out. And they had the masks. But there was no dust control. And most of those old fellas all ended up, you could hear them in the bar. If you were sitting there, you say, oh, he works on the elevator. The cough, They all developed a horrible cough.
Did you see that in your dad at all?
Oh, yeah, he coughed, sure. You could hear him in the morning before he even got to work. He'd cough and his guts out. And off they went, pedaling their bike.
Did they die early then? Or they just had a cough?
I never kept track.
So major changes over time then was dust control, obviously the yeah, safety.
Filter safety, sure.
Yeah, that would be it in your line of work, the major changes?
The safety came after, much after I retired, as far as in our business.
The fall protection.
Yeah, well. We would go out sometimes stupidly 12 o'clock at night to do a ship because they wanted it done first thing in the morning. Well, how do you inspect a ship at night when your heli has a little flashlight, but you got on your hands and knees and you looked around as best you could? But it was dangerous and it was stupid. We're just doing it for the ship owners to make a better profit. That's all.
And your pride to get a job done?
Yeah, no, I don't think it was pride at the end. It was just stupidity. But you see, a lot of those ships that came here were charters. And say you're chartering the ship from me, and you'd say to me, I will pay the daily expense of the ship the minute agriculture gives you the certificate saying the ship is ready to load. Okay, so as the owner comes up here, he wants to get this ship off his hands right away, as fast as he can, because it's, at that time, maybe $6,000 or $8,000 or $10,000 a day to run that ship, with fees and everything, fuel. So if he could get the inspector out at 2 a.m. in the morning to pass this ship, to give this, the minute I put the time down at 11 o'clock at night, the owner says, none of the bills are mine now, they're all yours. You pay for the fuel, you pay for everything. So they didn't care what time they called us, whether it's Saturday, Sunday, Monday, or holidays, or Christmas Day. Then they got so panicky they would hire a tug to take us out to the anchorage where the ship was anchored and do the inspection. So now we had anchorage, free. This was all free. So all of a sudden the federal government says, this is kind of crazy that we're providing all this service and we're not making any money here. It's costing us money. So then they come up with this cost recovery plan. So now if we go to inspect a hold, one or two holds, you pay so much. You pay so much for a weekend, you pay so much for anchorage. Now they've got a real scheme where, and you also pay for the phytosanitary certificate.
Did that make any difference in your
No. It just made them say, well, we want you now, we're paying. We didn't care if it's $1,000, we want you to come and inspect the ship. So that has changed. Before it was all free. You as a homeowner wanted to send plants to your auntie in California, but California says, the United States says we want a phytosanitary certificate from your Department of Agriculture saying blah blah blah. Well, you'd come to the office with your plants, we'd check them over and say, well, that's fine, yeah, make out the phytosanitary certificate, and off you went. Now we are being driven nuts by people doing this, you know, either way. So now I think it's a $50 fee if you want to send your plants to California to your Aunt Helen. You have to pay for that certificate. So that cut all that out.
Did the charging cut, it didn't cut down on any inspections at all?
No. As far as shipping goes, no.
Yeah, because the cost of not having it done was greater than...
You're talking big dollars. It was a beautiful thing before because they got it all for free.
What would you describe as your major challenges on the job?
My major challenge was trying to identify some of these insects that I picked up. I'm not a trained entomologist. Just picked it up with books and diagrams in the office, and we would boil up the larvae and use a microscope and try to follow some of these books with their various stages of identification. That was our real challenge a lot of times, is putting a name to the insect. Is it an injurious insect? Is it a stored products insect? I don't know. Or is it something that's out in the field here? That was the biggest challenge.
If you weren't able to identify it locally,
we'd send it away to Ottawa. But by the time Ottawa got it, I mean, the ship is sitting there. They want to know, What are we doing? So I always erred on the safe side. Spray it, you know, if it was insects, depending how many I found. But some of them, like if you found one or two insects, you didn't do anything about it. But if you found them regular in your inspection, then you'd say, whoa, there's a problem here. But the biggest challenge for me was identifying the insect.
Where would, like if you looked at all the insects that you found over your career, did they come from far and wide?
Yep. I think when I was poking through what they call dunnage, when they load steel, they put raw wood or rough wood. Anyways, I picked up some of this wood, and there was holes in it, and I took it back to the office and got this bug out of it, and I couldn't identify it, so I sent it to Ottawa, and of course, they have entomologists on staff, and they came back and said, oh, that's a real dandy. We've never seen that one before, and they'd written it up in one of the journals, found in Thunder Bay, this insect, and there was another Capra beetle, was it? It was, yeah. They had this thing about Capra beetle, and it was, bells went off all over the place. And anyways, the ship came from Duluth. We found Capra beetle on it, and again, we fumigated it. And but other than that, nothing sticks out in my mind.
So, in a sense, not only were you protecting Canada's grain, because we're obviously interested in the grain, protecting Canada's grain from being infested and then being opened up at the delivery end and, mm-hmm. and having this problem that it didn't start out with. But you're also protecting Canada from these things being transferred from the ships into the country.
Yeah, yeah. And at the end, we were even doing, what was it? Oh, was it garbage? No, that was Health Avanos. The veterinarian would go and he would make sure that the garbage was disposed of properly from the ships. The garbage. If a ship came from Montreal and didn't have a bill that showed that he had had garbage taken off and came here and had no garbage, say, well, where is the garbage? So there was an awful big fine if you dumped your garbage in the Great Lakes. Similarly, if you when they pulled into Montreal and these ships did not have any meat from approved countries, they had to have the meat lockers, freezers sealed up. They would have to buy Canadian meat. They didn't want hoof and mouth going all over the world. So at the end, the veterinarian wasn't here, so we were looking at, make sure the seals were on the ship's freezers and garbage and stuff of that nature. We were also looking after rabies stuff, but we won't get into that.
Why not?
No, we don't want to go there.
Tell me about rabies.
Well, no, again, the veterinarian, one had retired and they hadn't filled the position, so if you called up and said, I was bitten by a squirrel, and I got the squirrel or a bat, then we'd have to go down and pick up this article and send it away for a rabies test, or a dog bit you or something. We'd have to take the head off, or a wolf or whatever. Yeah, we just cut the head off.
Hmm.
We were doing that.
Interesting job.
Yeah, we were doing a lot of different things. It was interesting.
Any other challenges then? You talked about the challenges of identifying bugs. Any challenges of just working in that type of job, an inspection type of job, or an enforcer type of job?
You know, people would go across this border and bring hay back, and they weren't supposed to bring hay back, and bring lumber and stuff. All, you know, they don't think of that. Once you cross the line, you've got rules and regulations that you cannot do. You know, you can't even bring blueberries from that side of the line. I mean, they're growing, but again, you get all these calls from Canada Customs. This person brought all these acorns from California because they're going to do craft work. Well, you can't have acorns from California come here unless you've had them mm-hmm. checked over by their Department of Agriculture and given a phytosanitary. What will we do with them? Well, you have to burn them, throw them away, get rid of them, send them back.
Speaking of challenges, and I'm wondering about, this is actually going back to something that you said earlier about the big price that the shippers had to pay in order to just keep the ship running, and therefore they want to work really fast to get things done.
That's if you're a charter.
Yeah.
I don't know what the other part is.
I've just wondered about this question. You don't have to answer it, and you may not even have an answer to it. But was, how can I put this? Were bribes ever an issue from...
I never came across one. Like somebody bribing me to look the other way. No, I'd never come across that. And we were talking in the office one time, and we were saying, well, we never had this occasion. And the word, I think that what it is, the word got out that we were fair, but we weren't buyable. So even before they got to the lakehead, like the drums were beating, that don't even bother. That it may do you more harm than good if you try this. So we were never approached to, offered money to look the other way if there's a big cleanup job. We heard that from, I think it was a German captain. He said, you know, we heard about you people. I said, oh, pretty bad, eh? No, he said, you were fair, but don't try to bribe. So he said, oh, that's nice to know. And even the port wardens over here said, yeah, he said, in the lake you have a reputation that don't try it. So that's all I can say.
Were other places?
I can't say. I don't know.
Can't say.
Well, I imagine around the world it's depending.
Yep. In your mind, what were the most significant events that occurred in your work career?
I can't think of anything. I'd say the opening of the Seaway was a big event, but it was before I even started.
I think you've talked a lot about your memories. I'm going to ask this question anyway in case there's something that you want to add. What are your most vivid memories about your work life? The people that you encountered, the stories?
I think it was the people, yeah. Right from the elevator worker to the stevedore, all the people that involved in this trade, we're all first-rate people. I remember being told we're going to inspect the Lakers when the grain is up on the in the hold. We're going to go and look underneath the deck. Again, I'm telling you about arches. I said, we're going to jump in the grain? Yeah, he said, we'll try it. I said, well, won't we sink to the bottom? No, I don't think so. So anyways, we would say to the grain trimmers, when the grain gets about 2 foot from the upper deck, could you move the spout? And we want to, sure, and they would pull the, you know, that big spout they're loading, and we would jump onto the grain, go underneath and take a look. We even made videos for training purposes. But then as soon as we showed up on the lake and they were loading the grain, they'd say, yeah, where do you want to go, Vic? You want to go over there? Yeah, they would put the spout, they would just drive the grain down there and then they pull it back. And they'd watch out for it, you know, they'd say, well, keep an eye on this guy underneath there. So we had great cooperation.
Where did you go under?
Well, there's the hatch and there's a big steel frame around the hatch, okay? It's open, they're pouring the grain. But you have to get under that little frame and to go underneath and look underneath where they're walking, because they had this wide arch. When I'm saying an arch, it's maybe that wide with the steel in the middle of it, like an I-beam sort of thing. So we would go under there and take samples, scrape it off. It's the only way you can get up there unless you want to get these long ladders from the bottom. But we were doing that on a regular basis, go underneath, and we'd go there alone sometimes, one guy, and we'd say to the boss trimmer. We're going to go and eat. Yeah, okay, go ahead. No, and they'll be all watching for you and wait till you got out. And if you couldn't get out, they'd say, back off, and they'd make a pile of grain. You walk on top the grain and get out. So that was nice.
I guess you wouldn't be doing that with flax.
I think I did.
Because I've heard of people actually drowning in flax.
I can't remember. I don't think I ever... I don't know. It's slippery, isn't it? Yeah. Don't think there was that much traffic in flax here, for some reason or other. Or even rapeseed. No, we can't say rapeseed anymore. We've got to say canola. Canola seed and mustard seed. Yeah, you're right. I can't remember flaxseed. Well, you didn't sink that much. It was hard. It's like walking in snow that deep, ain't you?
I think I've asked most of my questions. Are there any questions that you think I should have asked you? Things that you wanted to say that you haven't had a chance to say?
Not really. When you talk to people around that are loading ship, they knew the routine when a ship pulled in. They would say, they'd be tying up the ship. They'd say, ready to load? Can't load until the bug man comes. So they knew the bug man, and they didn't do anything until the bug man came and said it was clear. That was funny, how they called us the bug man. So you talk to any one of them and say, the bug man has been here, we're not doing nothing yet. Even the elevator guy said, nothing until the bug man comes. So that's what we were called, the bug man.
You wore that name with pride?
Oh, sure. Yeah. But Mr. Clean, we had white coveralls and a white hard hat and the light on the top of it. And first time we would come out with a white hard hat and the light, they all started to laugh. And then after a while, you were accepted. They knew who you were. They said, there's the bug man. You can't do anything until he's finished.
You had mentioned that you had done a training video at one time. Where would that be housed, if it even still exists?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Where was your office? Headquarters.
Our office. We started out at the Syndicate Avenue post office. Then we went to 430 Waterloo, right next to the Mounties. Then we went to Euclid Avenue, behind Robbins there, by the Canadian Tire Gas Bar. And I think that's where I retired from. I think they're over here at the UIC building, inner city. You know, where you get your passports. There's a mall in there. I don't think it's there. You mean looking for the video?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's there. They hired somebody locally to do it. In fact, the fellow that was in the video with me, he was here for supper on Thursday, but he left yesterday for parts. He phones me, he travels. He just gets on planes and he travels. I'll ask him where that video ended up. It was sort of a training video for doing Lakers.
And would that have been out of Ottawa, food inspection? Have been their initiative?
I think so, yeah.
So they might have.
They might. Something. He might have got a copy of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
We had a lot of photographs. I don't know what happened to them. We had a whole bunch of photographs. They were building the grain storage during the war. During the war effort at Cargill, where they were building those. Remember, a lot of them had the old wooden grain storage. I don't know what ever happened to those.
Who had those?
I'll have to ask this fellow. He had a copy of them. He had the negatives. They were done by the Fryer Studio. You ever hear of the Fryer Studio? They were the old 8x10 negatives, you know, from the old. But he had the actual black and whites and the negatives, so I don't know whatever happened to them. Somebody gave them to him.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened.
Who is this person?
Bill Hunt.
Bill Hunt. Okay.
He's my friend that has the maze. You've heard of the maze?
So did he work in
job
as you?
Yeah, he was the officer in charge.
Okay. Yeah. So would he be a good person to interview? if you can catch him in between flights.
Well, he was the last guy that worked on the job. The first fellow was Gordy Powell, and he's retired. He's down at the coast. And it was John Van Loon, and I think he went to the Grain Commission. I don't know where he would be now. But Viper, I think Bill could probably. I'll have to ask Bill next time he calls me or sends me an email.
Ian Dew is sitting in on this interview as well. Are there questions that you have that I didn't touch on?
No, they've probably all been dealt with different ways. What was the most common problem you encountered?
In the shipping or the elevators or what?
In either.
In the ships, mostly extraneous material, that if they had unloaded steel or whatever they had, they hadn't cleaned it up properly. They were in a big rush. Or they had bad weather, they couldn't do it between wherever they unloaded the steel to when they got to the lake ports. In the earlier years, it was rust, everything, but in later years, the ships just changed completely. Mm-hmm. Better design, less maintenance.
Most frequent problem in the elevators?
Just spillage. They wouldn't get at it right away. The ships we used to get, believe it or not, oil tankers in here that had been carrying crude oil. Now, if you know crude oil, it's like molasses. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how they ever clean those ships up. We just say no, it's not. They're not suitable to carry the grain, and they would spend weeks. I don't know what they did. They would clean out the crude oil. It was like molasses.
Well,
I think that's a very important question for people interested in environment. How did they get those things clean?
I can tell you.
Ron worked on one once.
My husband, Ron, at his summer job was to go in and clean out the hold of a ship that had oil of some sort in it, and they just used rags.
I think he was on a tanker, I think.
Yeah, rags.
Rags, yeah. Wiped it down.
So lots of cheap student labor, and, well, I don't even know if it was that cheap.
No, they were paying pretty good.
And down in
But
the
I
hole.
Think what they did was they, you know, they have an awful lot of dust in the elevators that they collect. It's from, I think what they did, I suspect what they did is they give it a good couple of good shots of dust in these tanks and let it settle on all the raw oil and then loaded the grain.
Hmm. So you never, when you had an order to have it cleaned, did you go back to
look? Yes, when you...
So wouldn't you catch something like that?
You know, I can't remember because it was early in my career and that doesn't, I remember it being on the tanker and saying, holy, I got to throw these clothes away. It, you know, just molasses stuck all over. Or the coveralls. But I can't recall what the hang we ended up doing.
Yeah.
I can't.
Like if it was molasses, no big deal, right? But if it was oil.
Crude oil is like molasses, that consistency. Okay, so. Now, whether they heated it up and... Mm-hmm. Normally, they have a system, what they call butterworthing. Whereas they put a hot, like a big propeller that shoots out water, but it's boiling hot water, and they start at the top, and this thing spins, and they put it down, and they wash all the crude oil down till they get it down in the hold, and then they pump it out. Right. They extrude the crude oil and just pump the water out. It's called butterworthing, if I recall. But that's really boiling water that they had.
Under pressure,
and it just spun around like a big prop, and they put it in every hold and got the... Because to move crude oil, I think it has to be warm, mm-hmm. otherwise it doesn't move. I'm not too sure though.
And then it would be pumped into the lake.
Probably at that time, yes. Mm-hmm. No, not necessarily in a lake. I would say that this was done either at a sea or at a port where they could take the separate it, and then all you got is hot water, but. You when the seaway opened, you couldn't pump your ballast, or is it now you can't pump your ballast out in the lakes? That's because now we got the eel. Is it the?
We've got all kinds of
the lamprey and
lamprey. Yeah, But I think now they're pretty choosy what you pump out. Kind of late though.
As you know, we're trying to get a center established in Thunder Bay to preserve the history of the grain trade in Thunder Bay. If such a center were to come into being, what parts of the work that you did do you think it would be the most important to preserve so that the public could know your part in it?
You think they'd really be interested?
Let's say they are, okay. And I would say yes.
I would say if you had a display of the various stored product insects that are found in grain, that sort of thing.
And where they originated from? Sort of bugs of the world?
No, I would say bugs you pick up in the prairies that are Canadian, that would be in the grain. Because what originates here, we can control. But you're going to excuse me, I'm getting dry. Anybody want a glass of water? How about some soft drink? Yeah, okay.
Okay, I'll start up again. Just let me know. Questions that he'd like to ask before we end the interview.
These are more general. On our tour, we discovered temporary storage left over from the war, which was apparently where grain was just dumped on these stages outside. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see anything like that?
Let me think now. Yes. Patterson had I think they called it the pagoda, and it was just huge tanks that the grain was in. Where else? Manitoba Pool 3 had, theirs was steel. Yeah, just big steel tanks. But some of them, were made out of wood. But I think by the time I got around to them, they were all taken down. But I do remember Patterson's. They called it the pagoda, and it was off to the side by itself. And Pool 3, I think they're still standing at Pool 3, the first tanks you come. Yeah, and that's all I can remember at this stage.
I'm getting a picture from all the people that I'm listening to from all over the business, mm-hmm. that the grain business was a tough business in terms of labor relations and... Did you see anything of that?
I don't think they had that many strikes in the grain business. I think what you've got to keep in mind that a lot of these people were immigrants, and they were so grateful to have a job that they never complained as far as, you know, about grain, about the work conditions. They were happy to have a job. Hmm. And, I don't think there was that much, as far as my recollection. I'm old, but not that old.
Would your dad have ever said anything about those kinds of...
No. As I said, a lot of these people were just happy to have a job. And the working condition to them, well, it's grain. You're going to have dusty conditions. Yeah, a lot of immigrant workers in there that they were happy to have a job.
That's it, then?
That's it.
Well, this has been a very interesting